Native plants are increasingly popular with Missourians for a wide range of reasons. For home landscapers, natives provide food for pollinators and, of course, beautiful spaces to admire. For those with livestock, select native plants can provide nutritious grasses for grazing. Rebuilding the native landscape can be a labor of love. My name is Trevor Harris, sitting in for Darren Helwidge, and on this week's Thinking Out Loud, we talk with Elizabeth Hamilton Steele. She co-owns and co-manages Hamilton Native Outpost, a seed-raising operation in Texas County, Missouri. As we hear from Elizabeth, one way we can know what was on the land before European settlers set up housekeeping is to read the journals of early explorers. We'll also weave in today some radio theater, if you will, with help from local thespian Chris Bowling, reading from the diaries of early explorer of the Ozarks, Henry Rose Schoolcraft. That's this week on Thinking Out Loud. My name is Trevor Harris from KBIA's Thinking Out Loud, and one of our guests this week on the program is a native plant restorationist, if that's the right term. Elizabeth Hamilton Steele is with Hamilton Native Outpost in Elk Creek, Missouri. You may say, where is Elk Creek, Missouri, and what is Hamilton Native Outpost? We'll let Elizabeth speak for herself. Elizabeth, how are you today?
I'm well, and yourself?
I'm very good. I'm pleased you could make some time to be with KBIA before your Saturday, June 14th workshop. Elizabeth will be doing a workshop, Converting Fescue to Native Grasses and Wildflowers at Bradford Research and Extension Center, otherwise known as Bradford Farm on Rangeline Road, east of Columbia. Elizabeth, let's put this in some context. What do you do in Elk Creek, and where is Elk Creek?
Elk Creek is in south central Missouri. We're about an hour south of Rolla, or 3 hours south of Columbia there. And we work with native grasses and wildflowers. We raise seed.
Who is your audience for the seed? Who are you selling to?
The seed goes a couple of different ways. One group of folks that is interested in the seed would be people that are doing a landscaping project. Say you want a wildflower meadow out behind the house, and it's big enough that, you know, it's not practical to do it from potted plants. Then you may want to consider doing it from seeds. So that the aesthetics is one group of folks that are interested in it. Another group of folks that are interested is those interested in wildlife and creating habitat for the wildlife that would have been here, whether that's, you know, the pollinators, which are in decline right now, the native pollinators, whether that's, you know, some of the other insects or some of the birds or quail, for instance. Prairie chickens are both down in numbers from what they have been historically. So folks interested in wildlife are another group, and then folks interested in grazing. The ranchers out there that want to, you know, plant a forage for summer production of grass, that's another part of our audience. And then I guess the last one is kind of just those folks who are interested in restoring a native habitat. You know, they want to have prairie out there, or they want to have a savanna out there for whatever reason. That would kind of be the last group of folks interested in native plants.
If I was interested in growing native plants, and I am, and I had a certain size landscape, whether it was a postage stamp yard or maybe I had 10 or 20 or 100 acres I wanted to convert, I know what I like. I know what looks pretty, and I know some things that attract habitat, but how can I do the research on what historically was on my landscape? What plants were there?
Well, you can, there's a couple different resources that a lot of times I look at. One would be the explorers, the early explorers that came through the area. So in my part of the country, we had an explorer named Henry Rose Schoolcraft that came through and described what was growing here when very few people were living here. It was somewhat settled, but in the early 1800s is when he came through. So if there's an explorer like that that came through and described, you know, what he was seeing, he or she was seeing at that time, that is a good resource.
Henry Rose Schoolcraft traveled through Missouri in the winter of 1818 and 1819. That's a year before Missouri became a state. Schoolcraft and his travel companion Levi Pettibone encountered wide open spaces, a few Osage Indians, and French settlers mostly engaged in lead mining in the eastern Ozarks. Here's a selection from what Schoolcraft and Pettibone encountered on November 7, 1818, as they began their trip near modern-day Potosi.
Saturday, November 7th. After traveling 14 miles, the day being nearly spent, we arrived at an inhabited cabin and obtained permission to remain for the night. Our path this day has lain across an elevated ridge of land covered with yellow pine and strewed with fragments of sandstone, quartz, and a species of coarse flinty jasper, the soil being sterile and the vegetation scanty. The weather has been mild and very pleasant for the season, with an unclouded sky and light breeze from the southwest. General course of traveling west-southwest. Distance, 14 miles.
To know and understand the historic landscape of Missouri, one can get acquainted with the writings of early explorers like Henry Rowe Schoolcraft. Native plant seed farmer Elizabeth Hamilton Steele has some other tips for those considering a large or small-scale landscape restoration effort.
Another one is the old GLO notes, which are the survey notes when the country was originally surveyed. You know, those surveyors, when they went to set a corner, would have to describe what was around them. So, you know, they might have set a rock in this certain place, and then they would describe, well, you had to go, you know, so many yards, or they used different measurements, but you had to go so far to get to the next tree that they made a witness tree. So you could get an idea, you know, if they were in a prairie, they didn't have the ability to use witness trees there, so that would be reflected in those old notes. That's probably some of the best ways. The other ways are just more generalized. The flatter the landscape, the more likely it was to be a treeless expanse because the fires could go across there better. The landscape was less dissected. And that's reflected in the flatter landscapes of western Missouri, the flatter landscapes in some parts of northern Missouri. Those were a lot prairie. When you got down into the Ozarks and you get more dissected landscapes, bigger hills and hollers, the fire couldn't go across the landscape. There's things to break up the fire. There's hollers to, you know, that it doesn't back down into very well. So the fire frequency down here was less. As a result, you ended up with more trees. And so you ended up with more of a savanna look, which is, you know, a bunch of big trees out there in the field with lots of grasses and wildflowers in between. Maybe 30% of the ground was shaded. And you also ended up with more shaded things like woodlands, which is the term used to refer to places that have, you know, maybe half and half or a little more than half and half shade and cover of wildflowers and native grasses. So those are some of the tools that you can use to kind of figure out what was in your area historically.
So I can know what was in my area historically, and that helps. How do I know what is right for my site? One of the things that you refer to on the website for Hamilton Native Outpost is glades, prairies, and savannas. Can you talk a little bit about the nature of those three and how they're distinct?
Glades, prairies, and savannas. There's two ways that I think of both plants and their adaptation and native ecosystems. And those are by soils and by sun or shade. And so I guess let's start with soils. We have everything on a continuum from really dry to really wet. Really dry would be, you know, in Missouri, we call them glades a lot of times, an area that's shallow to bedrock. And so on the other end of the continuum would be, you know, a river where it's really wet. You get in over your head and you're wet. So plants, you know, have a certain place that they like it in there. An obvious example, most folks are familiar with cattails. If you take a cattail and you plant it on a glade, it's not going to survive. And vice versa, if you take one of our native cactuses, let's say the prickly pear cactus, and you plant it down next to, you know, the riverside or underwater even, it's not going to survive there either. So plants need to be in their habitat. And the other continuum that I like to think about is sun and shade. And so on that continuum, we have everything from treeless expanses, which is a prairie, to a treed expanse, which is a forest. And, you know, as you move down that continuum, so if we start at prairie and we add a few trees to the mix, but we still have those prairie grasses and wildflowers, we call that a savanna. If we move further down the continuum and we add more trees to the mix, but we still have some of the native grasses and wildflowers, we call that a woodland. And when we get to where we really have none of the native grasses and wildflowers left, but we have, or maybe a few, but, you know, they're the woodland types that tolerate really heavy shade and lots of trees than were in the forest ecosystems.
If you're approaching doing a native restoration project on your property, whether it's an urban yard or you've got a pasture you want to convert, it's important to know what was there historically. It's important to know the soil types and the moisture content, whether it's sunny versus whether it's shady. There's also the reality of the year, that in terms of doing a restoration project, you probably don't want to plant your seeds in August.
There is definitely a certain time to do, you know, each of the things. And when you're talking about native grass and wildflower seeds, for the most part, they need planted in the winter. The exception are some of the native grasses, which can be planted in the spring. But really, you don't want to do fall plantings, like a traditional fall planting, say August, early September, like you might do with a fescue yard. You don't want to plant them then at all. The ones that need planted in winter, they actually have a dormancy built into them. That it's Mother Nature's way of making sure they don't germinate in the middle of summer when they fall off the plant, when they're ripe. When the seeds ripen in summer, they fall off the plant, and they get the fall rains. If they were to germinate then, they wouldn't be big enough to make it through winter. So there is an inbuilt mechanism in the plant, in that seed, that says, I have to go through winter because I know that after winter comes spring, and if I germinate in spring, I've got a long growing season ahead of me to get big, develop my root system, and make it through winter. So there is definitely a time, and, you know, there's, as you, not only a time to seed, but there's also a time to, I lost my train of thought there.
You were dipping into Ecclesiastes. You were going to start telling us, and there's a time to dance.
There you go. Yeah, there's a time to seed, there's a time to dance, if you will, and there's a time to, you know, do the steps to lead up to a successful planting, which is getting rid of what's growing there, if you do indeed have something else growing there.
Walking and riding his horse across the Missouri Ozarks, Henry Rowe Schoolcraft saw in 1818 and 1819 a landscape not yet altered by modern humans. Indigenous people had small-scale farms and hunted on the Ozarks land Schoolcraft was visiting. Indians also occasionally burned some landscapes to drive out game. The fires set by their hand or by summer lightning storms also helped suppress undesirable woody species. By New Year's Day 1819, explorer Schoolcraft and travel companion Levi Pettibone had made it from modern-day Potosi to near modern-day Springfield, Missouri. Here's a selection from Henry Rowe Schoolcraft's journal from New Year's Day 1819.
Friday, January 1st. On quitting the cave, we entered on a district of country characterized by gentle sloping hills, well wooded with oak and hickory, with some extensive prairies and a pretty fertile black soil, and encamped last night on the banks of a small stream, afforded some handsome sites for plantations. On traveling 2 miles this morning, we entered a rich and extensive valley and found ourselves unexpectedly on the banks of James's River, the stream we were in search of. It is the principal northwestern fork of White River, and a large, clear, and beautiful stream. It originates in highlands, a little south of the Gasconade River, which falls into the Missouri above St. Charles, and running in an opposite direction for 250 miles, forms a junction with the South Fork of White River, 100 miles below. Along its banks are found extensive bodies of the choicest land, covered by a large growth of forest trees and cane, and interspersed with prairies. Oak, maple, white and black walnut, elm, mulberry, hackberry, and sycamore are the common trees, and attain a very large size. On the west commences a prairie of unexplored extent, stretching off towards the Osage River and covered with tall, rank grass. Towards its mouth, it is said to be bordered with high, rocky bluffs. We forded the river on horseback and, pursuing up its western bank about 4 miles, encamped along the shore in the vicinity of a lead mine. Distance 6 miles. Weather cold and piercing. Killed one prairie hen and one goose.
Back here in modern times, I'm Trevor Harris, and this is Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. On this week's program, in between selections from Henry Rowe Schoolcraft's diary, as read by Chris Bowling, that detail his Ozark exploration in the winter of 1818 and 1819, I'm talking with native landscape restorationist and seed grower Elizabeth Hamilton Steele about what kind of time is required to rebuild a piece of land to contain a diverse mix of species. You have this very detailed and useful planting timeline on the website at hamiltonnativeoutpost.com. And it really looks like it's a 3-year process, at least to get your site selected, prepared, and planted, whether it's from seed or from plants. Can you talk a little bit about the process of removing the plants that you don't want?
Mm-hmm. So a big part of establishing the native plants is to get rid of what's growing there, because whatever's growing there is what you don't want, since you're getting rid of it, and it's going to compete with the plants that you're trying to get established. So the process that's involved, it generally, I guess there's a couple different ways to do it, but the easiest one is to come in and spray glyphosate on the area, and we generally start that in the fall. When you have nice regrowth there in the fall, when you're having to mow your yard again, you know that fescue, if that's what you're starting with, is actively growing. Come in, spray your herbicide, and then we come back in the spring. And your goal then, you've killed the mother plants in the fall, but they're seedlings that are germinating. So we come in, we kill those off in the spring, we allow them to germinate again, and then we come back in the fall and do the same thing. People have mixed opinions on using glyphosate, and there are a few other options. You can use black plastic, and you can use repeated tillage. Both of these are slow, tedious. The easiest way is with glyphosate, but, you know, if folks are adamantly opposed to it, you know, there's some other options they can explore that are less well-known. You know, people don't, in restoration, don't tend to use them as much, so there's not as much of a body of knowledge out there on, you know, how to do it and how long some of it takes and whatnot. And there's risks associated with that, too. It's not like, you know, any action we take on the environment has consequences. So those are not free of consequences either. You know, for instance, with the repeat tillage, you know, run a big risk of soil erosion as you're leaving that ground bare and you're coming back in and, you know, tilling repeatedly. So the first step is to get rid of what's growing there, and that takes us generally about a year and a half. And then you come in after that final spray in the fall, and you plant your seeds that winter, and then it's a slow process to get the plants established. So don't be disappointed when you don't have many blooms that first couple years. In fact, a lot of the Missouri perennial wildflowers take 3 years before they will bloom. If you get something slightly out of sight, or it is a plant that has a bigger root system and just needs longer to develop, it could be 5 years before they bloom. So establishing native grasses and wildflowers is not for the impatient sort of folks, because even though you may get a few blooms the first year, there are some species in there that will give you some blooms, usually the first year, definitely the second year. But a lot of them are slower to establish. The coneflowers, for instance, and some of those, they're just slower to establish, and you need to expect that.
Well, be careful what you ask for. My coneflowers, I every year in my yard am doing an eradication.
It is true.
I'm taking them out consistently from places I don't want them because they love it so much in the clayey Columbia soil. What do you recommend for mulch to keep the moisture down and suppress some of the weeds?
Well, this comes to kind of what approach is. If your approach is a small area that it's manageable to use some mulch and whatnot, there's no problem with using some. You do need to keep in mind that as you use mulch, usually it's high carbon, and you can create some carbon-nitrogen ratio issues where the plants don't have enough nitrogen to really thrive because that nitrogen is being used to decompose your mulch. But there's no problem with using mulch necessarily. My experience is more on the bigger landscape scale things, whether that might just be, you know, a couple hundred square foot that's really not practical to, you know, take care of with mulch and whatnot. So in that case, what we tend to do is to make sure we have grasses in the mix. And the grasses act as a water preservation mechanism. But a big part of the water thing is to get the plants that are adapted. It comes back to, you know, put a dry loving plant in a dry situation and put a wet loving plant in a wet situation. Now, you can put a wet loving plant on a dry situation if you really want it, but be aware you are going to have to take more care of it. You're going to need to irrigate it. Whereas if you put the plants in the right place, they can be a really low maintenance, you know, you don't need to water them necessarily for them to survive and thrive even. But you do need to make sure that what you get there is adapted. So I guess to come back to mulch, the grasses do create a mulch, and they do help suppress the weeds in between the plants. The leaf structure is different between a grass and a wildflower, and I always like to put any seeding that I'm doing, I like to put some amount of grasses in there for the shading of the soil that it does to discourage the weed seeds from germinating. If you choose to use a controlled burn as a management technique, it gives you some fuel to carry that fire, and it also helps hold up some of the wildflowers. If you've got them in good soil and they want to lean over a little bit, it can give you a little support for the wildflowers and provide some winter color as well.
Talk to me about some specific plants that are popular now and might work in an urban landscape. If a lot of people listening have city yards and they're thinking, well, I'd like to do some restoration, but I'm not going to go and tear up half an acre of grass, and I want to start with a small area, what are some plants that would do well?
There's a lot of pretty plants, whether they're popular or not, and some of the you do need to be careful and, you know, get other folks' experience with a planting that's similar to yours, because some can be aggressive and, you know, more so in a certain situation, whereas in another, you know, if you plant them in a flower bed, that plant might be aggressive. Whereas if you plant it in a diverse, you know, wildflower meadow, it's not necessarily a problem. So what plants are popular? Since we just deal in seeds, a lot of times it's the mixes, so that, you know, you don't necessarily have to know all of the different species to get 20 or 30 species out there on the landscape that are adapted to your site.
Every landscape we seek to modify has already been altered in some way by earlier humans. One early chronicler of Ozark's landscapes was Henry Rowe Schoolcraft. He struck out from near Potosi in the winter of 1818 to explore the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas and Missouri. During a three-month-long winter journey, Schoolcraft and travel companion Levi Pettibone walked through Missouri's Merrimack, Gasconade, James, and Black River's watersheds. During that period, they saw animals, plants, and people now long gone. Writing near the end of his sometimes arduous journey, Schoolcraft here describes the landscape near modern-day Fredericktown in the eastern Ozarks, Madison County, a landscape that was already altered by French miners when Schoolcraft arrived in 1819.
Tuesday, February 2nd. The rock strata here are calcareous. 2 miles southwest commences the tract of insular granite. These mines have been worked with little interruption for a century and are not yet exhausted, but, on the contrary, yield as much metal as formerly. Large piles of the ore, crystallized in shining facets, were lying near the road as I passed, and a number of workmen engaged either in the excavations or smelting. 9 miles below the mines, the traveler enters Cook's Settlement, a fine district of land in the interior of St. Genevieve County, with a rapidly increasing population. Here I reposed for the night.
I'm visiting with Elizabeth Hamilton Steele. She's with Hamilton Native Outpost in Elk Creek, Missouri. It's a family operation. The Hamiltons raise, harvest, clean, and sell native grass and wildflower seed. Tell us what folks can expect at the Native Plant Workshop this Saturday at Bradford Farm.
Well, we are going to do a lot of talking about how to get established a native planting, whether that planting is for landscaping, for wildlife, for forage, for restoration of a rare and declining habitat. Whatever your goals are, a lot of the process that you go through is similar. So we're going to do a lot of talking about how to get there, some of the unique things about some of the ecosystems, and, you know, just how to get from I have a dream of a planting to here it is on the landscape, what do I do with it now? And how to choose the species that you might put in there, all of that sort of stuff. There's certain species that people always love, like the coneflowers. And the purple coneflower, which is probably the one that you have, can tend to be more aggressive in landscaping. The pale purple and yellow cone flowers are other beautiful cone flowers that I find to be less aggressive. The purple poppy mallow is a beautiful species for dry sites. It has wine fuchsia-colored flowers on it.
You've been doing the seed raising and harvesting and plant sales now for several years. How long have you been at it?
My folks started the business, I don't know, something like 30 years ago. I kind of forget the exact date, but it was, you know, about the time that I was just first on the scene. And so I grew up in the business. Since my folks started the business, I will refer to it as an indentured servant through my childhood. And we worked with the plants. My mom likes to joke that growing up we knew more Latin names of plants than we knew names of, you know, popular musicians. So it's one of those things that you grow up knowing some of it just because that's what your family does. And then other things, when I came back after college and a short trip to Africa for some missionary work, I came back and worked with a family business. And there's other things that you start to learn then. So it's been a fun journey.
Where'd you go in Africa?
I was in, when I was in graduate school, there was a guy in graduate school from Kenya, and one of my friends, Melissa Remley, and myself went over and visited his family. And then I went down to Malawi and did agricultural mission work for about 3 months.
What did you think of the Malawian landscape?
There is a lot of corn, and they called it maize in Malawi. You know, it's subsistence agriculture, and it's, you know, friendly people. It was a lot of fun. It's a whole different experience, but it's a beautiful place.
My wife and I were Peace Corps volunteers in Zambia for a couple of years and made a few trips over to Malawi. And I was impressed just in the difference between those two countries, Malawi being much more densely populated and having a big lake in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
People's hut holds were a lot more diverse in terms of their plantings, whether it was edible plantings, medicinal, even landscaping, just shade trees around the house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was folks that would, you know, use the manure. You have a cow or whatever, if you're a privileged individual, or a oxen, and you use that manure to enrich the soil after you harvest the crops. And so there was definitely some of that going on.
That's it for this week. My thanks to Elizabeth Hamilton Steele. She'll be in Columbia this weekend for a workshop at Bradford Farm from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday called Converting Fescue to Native Grasses and Wildflowers. Details on the workshop are available at grownative.org. My thanks also to local thespian Chris Bowling for his readings from Henry Rowe Schoolcraft's diaries. That's it for Thinking Out Loud, not just for today, but for this season. We'll be back later in the summer with new installments of the program. Until then, you can listen to past episodes on our website. It's kbia.org. Just search on Thinking Out Loud. For Darren Helwidge, I'm Trevor Harris. Thanks for listening.